Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Katie Britton. John Green's The Fault in Our Stars debuted at number one on the New York Times bestsellers list for children's chapter books and has held firm in the past few weeks. And rightly so. It's soul-bearing and tear-inducing, yet wickedly funny as our characters Hazel and Augustus confront living with cancer and making the best of their circumstances. I spoke with Green about the novel and why their story needed to be told.
Well, almost 12 years ago, I worked as a student chaplain at a children's hospital for a few months, and ever since then, I've been wanting to write a story about two young people who are sick and funny and smart and adolescent, just like all the teenagers I knew when I worked at the hospital, but it took a very, very long time to finish it.
And you say that funny and smart in our characters, Hazel and Augustus, and even their parents, they have an almost wicked sense of humor to the extent that I was laughing out loud while I'm reading and then looking around to see if someone else heard and thought it was inappropriate to laugh.
Yeah, I mean, I want you to laugh even when you're uncomfortable, I guess. But, you know, people who are living even when they're very sick are still alive. And I think want to be treated as people who are still alive. And part of that means that they often have a very, very dark but extremely funny sense of humor. And hopefully I was able to capture some of that in the book.
You did, and you did it extremely well. You encompassed the whole package of these characters, not only just writing about teenagers with cancer, but the whole person, who they were before and are now, and that it doesn't define them as humans, but of course it changes their circumstances and lives.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's so easy for the well to look at the sick and see only illness, or to see only someone whose life has been circumscribed by illness, particularly when we're looking at young children. But the last thing that people need is pity, and that's also generally not what they want. They want to be alive. They want to be with us, and it's our responsibility and their responsibility to fight hard to try to be with each other.
And the characters say that. They say, I don't want that look of pity, of recognition, oh, they are sick, when they're out in public.
Yeah, the young woman who narrates the novel, Hazel, has a nasal cannula, and she has to carry around an oxygen tank in order to increase the oxygenation levels in her blood. And that is a physical evidence of her illness that she can never get rid of, and she can kind of never be free from that. So that means that every time anyone looks at her in public, naturally, the first thing that they think before they think whether she's pretty or how she's dressed or anything is that, oh my God, that person is seriously ill.
And in a way, she is obviously struggling with the cancer, but she sees herself as a caregiver to her parents to hold on for them. She's very astute to that.
Yeah, I think that adolescents are not known for being particularly empathic. I think some of that is unfair characterization, but I think some of it is fair. But when the sick teenagers I've known tend to be extremely empathic because they are acutely aware of everything that's going on around them and all the people who are being affected by their illness. You know, cancer is, and all serious disease affects whole families, not just individuals. And, you know, she's very aware of that, and she does not, you know, she's desperate not to be a sadness in her parents' lives. And, you know, it takes her a long time to realize that she isn't, and that her parents are, you know, genuinely very, very grateful to have her.
There's one instance in the book where she actually acts like a teenager, and she says, well, you always wanted for me to be a normal teenager, to go out and meet friends. I said, well, not in this way.
Right, exactly. Well, that's what all parents say. you want your kids to grow up, but you don't want them to, you also don't. And so when they do grow up, it's a disaster. when they do start to exhibit autonomy. I mean, I'm the father of a 2-year-old, and I'm experiencing that already. I want him to grow up and have a healthy, happy life. But, when he starts to be defiant and expresses autonomy, it's pretty frustrating.
And Hazel knows she's lucky that the drug trial that she's in, and it is a fictional drug trial, we should say, that it's working for her tumors in her lungs.
Right. Yeah, the drug that I made up, I wish it existed, but I made it up, is based on the the drug Herceptin, which is a very specific drug that works extremely, extremely well in the case of some breast cancers. And the drug that I made up is called Phalanxophore. And so she's sort of, Hazel's sort of in a place between illness and wellness. Like, she's never going to be well again, in the sense that she's never going to be, or at least probably never going to be, rid of her her oxygen tank and having her life circumscribed by disease and having to have fluid drained from her lungs periodically. But she's also, not dying, at least not in an immediate sense.
And I'd like to turn to Augustus. He's in remission and his leg has been amputated, and he's pretty much back to regular life, but he comes to the cancer support group for his friend Isaac.
Yeah, so Gus shows up at a cancer support group one day and notices Hazel and kind of can't stop staring at her, which Hazel interprets as his romantic interest. It actually turns out to be something else, at least initially. But yeah, he's very charming and good-looking and extraordinarily confident for a 17-year-old.
Now, it's interesting to me that you call him Gus.
I do, yeah. Because he goes, I chose the name Augustus because Augustus is like a big imperial name, whereas Gus is a small name for a small child or something. Like, one of my favorite books as a kid was called Gus is a Bug. And I wanted it to be both Augustus and Gus because I wanted Augustus to be this big, powerful, confident young man who, seems like he can get whatever he wants out of the world, and Gus to be a lot more fragile and weak and scared. And so I call him Gus because that's how I think of him, I guess. That's the Gus I like better.
And Hazel calls him Augustus, which says a lot.
She does.
Then.
She does, yeah, particularly at first. Because she sees him as this kind of larger-than-life character. He's so handsome, and he really likes her, and he's so willing to pursue it with, this, zest for life that's just kind of foreign to her. And it's really, really exciting to her. But then as time goes on, she sees him much more complexly.
And it's at this group, which Hazel, Isaac, and Gus all believe to be a platform for the facilitator to tell and retell his story of beating testicular cancer. But they form a bond of wisecracking jokes and the price of dawn.
Yeah, they're obsessed with this. They both really enjoy this book, The Price of Dawn, that's like a video game novelization. But then they both also like a different book. Hazel and Augustus, called An Imperial Affliction by Peter Van Houten, and they like the book so much they want to meet the author, who lives in Amsterdam, and that pushes a lot of the story.
They're just so enthralled with it because it is also about a teenage girl that has cancer.
Right, yeah, exactly. And I think Hazel wants answers about An Imperial Affliction. She wants to know what happens after the end of the book. Which is something that I hear a lot from my readers. I get a lot of emails and, Twitter messages and YouTube comments asking me what happens after the end of the book and for a couple of my earlier novels. And now, of course, I'm getting it for The Fault in Our Stars, too. But that's not something that an author knows a lot of times. And that's sort of what Hazel and Augustus eventually have to confront. I don't know what happens after the end of my books. I don't. Books belong to their readers, and I don't think that the author has a privileged voice in that conversation. So, you guys get to decide what happens.
Really? How do you let go of different characters then, and not carry them with you? Especially after, I'm assuming, spending so much time being a part of their lives.
Well, I write the novels to let it go. That's why I'm writing, is to be able to let it go and to be able to give it to my readers and hope that it's a good gift, hope that it's a useful gift or a beautiful gift. But in the end, like, for me, the making of the gift is the act of letting go. And then when the thing is made, I have to give it to you and it's not mine anymore.
It's a very beautiful way of thinking about it. And I feel it's just as poignant in a novel such as this when you have the characters who are learning that every day and their family and friends realizing that as well.
Yeah, it is analogous to what I wanted the characters to go through and the reader to have the same relationship with those characters. Although I have to say, as I was saying all of that, it did occur to me that even though it is a gift and the book belongs to its readers, I do want my royalties. So, you know, it's highfalutin rhetoric, but you don't see people generally walking away from their, from their intellectual property rights.
Well, I have to say, we were speaking about the fictional book, An Imperial Infliction, and that brings us to the title of the novel, The Fault in Our Stars. And when I first saw the book in the bookstore, I was thinking, I wonder what this is about. And now when I say the title, just saying it makes my heart just break a little bit more.
Oh, that's nice of you to say. This was a hard title to come by. We had a lot of other titles along the way, but we settled with The Fault in Our Stars. It's after the, quote, Julius Caesar Shakespeare play, where a Roman nobleman says to Brutus, "The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves," which is easy to say when you're a Roman nobleman or when you're Shakespeare. But for a lot of us, there is fault in our stars. And, you know, I wanted to write about that in a way that was going to be honest, but also hopeful. I believe that all honest stories are hopeful. And I wanted to, you know, capture the hope that that exists even within the fault in our stars.
As we turn each page, we're hoping for a miracle or a change in circumstances and one more funny line to break through the sadness.
Of course, yeah, and hopefully it stays. I mean, I think life stays funny throughout life, so hopefully the book stays funny throughout the book.
Well, it absolutely does. We do get those great zingers all the way to the very end of the novel from Gus and from Hazel and Isaac, who I like him as that supporting role where we get a different view of how he is dealing with his cancer.
Yeah, Isaac is a young man who has an extraordinarily improbable recurrence of a particular kind of eye cancer that usually affects very young children, and it causes him to go blind. He's been blind in one eye since he was a kid, but he goes blind in his other eye early in the novel. And his perspective on Hazel and Gus's relationship, but also on the sort of existential questions at the heart of the novel, was really important to me.
Well, John, this is an amazing novel. I have to tell you, when I was reading it, I was only about 5 or 6 pages in, and a man walks by and he says, "Oh my goodness, my student just told me to read that book, and I'm almost done with it, and it is phenomenal."
That's pretty amazing to hear. It's been a weird couple weeks. That's really exciting. Thank you for sharing that with me.
Again, the name of the novel is The Fault in Our Stars. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Again, the name of John Green's novel is The Fault in Our Stars. It is published by Dutton. For The Roundtable, I'm Katie Britton.